the vulgar or of the selinga will indifferently present the same uniform spectacle of similar and native manners. 1. The corn, or even the rice, which constitutes the ordinary and wholesome food of a civilized people, can be obtained only by the patient toil of the husbandman. Some of the happy savages who dwell between the tropics are plentifully nourished by the liberality of nature. But in the climates of the north, a nation of shepherds is reduced to their flocks and herds. The skillful practitioners of the medical art will determine, if they are able to determine, how far the temper of the human mind may be affected by the use of animal or of vegetable food, and whether the common association of carnivorous and cruel deserves to be considered in any other light than that of an innocent, perhaps a salutary, prejudice of humanity. Yet if it be true that the sentiment of compassion is imperceptibly weakened by the sight and practice of domestic cruelty, we may observe that the horrid objects which are disguised by the arts of European refinement are exhibited in their naked and most disgusting simplicity in the tent of a Tartarian shepherd. The ox or the sheep are slaughtered by the same hand from which they were accustomed to receive their daily food, and the bleeding limbs are served with very little preparation on the table of their unfeeling murderer. In the military profession, and especially in the conduct of a numerous army, the exclusive use of animal food appears to be productive of the most solid advantages. Corn is a bulky and perishable commodity, and the large magazines, which are indispensably necessary for the subsistence of our troops, must be slowly transported by the labor of men or horses. But the flocks and herds which accompany the march of the Tartars afford a sure and increasing supply of flesh and milk. And the far greater part of the uncultivated waste, the vegetation of the grass is quick and luxuriant, and there are few places so extremely barren that the hardy cattle of the north cannot find some tolerable pasture. The supply is multiplied and prolonged by the undistinguishing appetite and patient abstinence of the Tartars. They indifferently feed on the flesh of those animals that have been killed for the table or have died of disease. Horse flesh, which in every age and country has been prescribed by the civilized nations of Europe and Asia, they devour with peculiar greediness. And this singular taste facilitates the success of their military operations. The active cavalry of Scythia is always followed in their most distant and rapid incursions by an adequate number of spare horses, who may be occasionally used either to redouble the speed or to satisfy the hunger of the barbarians. Many are the resources of courage and poverty. When the forage round a camp of Tartars is almost consumed, they slaughter the greatest part of their cattle and preserve the flesh, either smoked or dried in the sun. On the sudden emergency of a hasty march, they provide themselves with a sufficient quantity of little balls of cheese, or rather of hard curd, which they occasionally dissolve in water. And this unsubstantial diet will support for many days the life and even the spirits of the patient warrior. But this extraordinary abstinence, which the Stoic would approve and the hermit might envy, is commonly succeeded by the most voracious indulgence of appetite. The wines of a happier climate are the most grateful present, or the most valuable commodity that can be offered to the Tartars, and the only example of their industry seems to consist in the art of extracting from mare's milk a fermented liquor, which possesses a very strong power of intoxication. Like the animals of prey, the savages, both of the old and new world, experience the alternate vicissitudes of famine and plenty, and their stomach is inured to sustain, without much inconvenience, the opposite extremes of hunger and of intemperance. 2. In the ages of rustic and martial simplicity, a people of soldiers and husbandmen are dispersed over the face of an extensive and cultivated country, and some time must elapse before the warlike youth of Greece or Italy could be assembled under the same standard, either to defend their own confines or to invade the territories of the adjacent tribes. The progress of manufactures and commerce insensibly collects a large multitude within the walls of a city, but these citizens are no longer soldiers, and the arts which adorn and improve the state of civil society corrupt the habits of the military life. The pastoral manners of the Scythian seem to unite the different advantages of simplicity and refinement. The individuals of the same tribe are constantly assembled, but they are assembled in a camp, and the native spirit of these dauntless shepherds is animated by mutual support and emulation. The houses of the Tartars are no more than small tents of an oval form which afford a cold and dirty habitation for the promiscuous youth of both sexes. The palaces of the rich consist of wooden huts of such a size that they may be conveniently fixed on large wagons and drawn by a team, perhaps, of 20 or 30 oxen. The flocks and herds, after grazing all day in the adjacent pastures, retire on the approach of night within the protection of the camp. The necessity of preventing the most mischievous confusion in such a perpetual concourse of men and animals must gradually introduce in the distribution the order and the guard of the encampment the rudiments of the military art. As soon as the forage of a certain district is consumed, the tribe, or rather army, of shepherds makes a regular march to some fresh pastures, and thus acquires, in the ordinary occupations of the pastoral life, the practical knowledge of one of the most important and difficult operations of war. The choice of stations is regulated by the difference of the seasons. In the summer, the Tartars advance towards the north and pitch their tents on the banks of a river, or at least in the neighborhood of a running stream. But in the winter, they return to the south and shelter their camp behind some convenient eminence against the winds, which are chilled in their passage over the bleak and icy regions of Siberia. These manners are admirably adapted to diffuse among the wandering tribes the spirit of emigration and conquest. The connection between the people and their territory is of so frail a texture that it may be broken by the slightest accident. The camp, and not the soil, is the native country of the genuine Tartar. Within the precincts of that camp, his family, his companions, his property, are always included. And in the most distant marches he is still surrounded by the objects which are dear or valuable or familiar in his eyes. The thirst of rapine, the fear or the resentment of injury, the impatience of servitude have in every age been sufficient causes to urge the tribes of Scythia boldly to advance into some unknown countries, where they might hope to find a more plentiful subsistence or a less formidable enemy. The revolutions of the North have frequently determined the fate of the South, and in the conflict of hostile nations, the victor and the vanquished have alternately drove and been driven from the confines of China to those of Germany. These great emigrations, which have been sometimes executed with almost incredible diligence, were rendered more easy by the peculiar nature of the climate. It is well known that the cold of Tartary is much more severe than in the midst of the temperate zone might reasonably be expected. This uncommon rigor is attributed to the height of the plains, which rise, especially towards the east, more than half a mile above the level of the sea, and to the quantity of saltpeter with which the soil is deeply impregnated. In the winter season, the broad and rapid rivers that discharge their waters into the Black Sea, the Caspian, or the Icy Sea, are strongly frozen. The fields are covered with a bed of snow, and the fugitive or victorious tribes may securely traverse with their families, their wagons, and their cattle, the smooth and hard surface of an immense plain. 3. The pastoral life, compared with the labors of agriculture and manufactures, is undoubtedly a life of idleness, and as the most honorable shepherds of the Tartar race devolve on their captives the domestic management of the cattle, their own leisure is seldom disturbed by any servile and deciduous cares. But this leisure, instead of being devoted to the soft enjoyments of love and harmony, is usefully spent in the violent and sanguinary exercise of the chase. The plains of Tartary are filled with a strong and serviceable breed of horses, which are easily trained for the purposes of war and hunting. The Scythians of every age have been celebrated as bold and skillful riders, and constant practice has seated them so firmly on horseback that they were supposed by strangers to perform the ordinary duties of civil life, to eat, to drink, and even to sleep, without dismounting from their steeds. They excel in the dexterous management of the lance. The long Tartar bow is drawn with a nervous arm, and the weighty arrow is directed to its object with unerring aim and irresistible force. These arrows are often pointed against the harmless animals of the desert, which increase and multiply in the absence of their most formidable enemy. The hare, the goat, the roebuck, the fallow deer, the stag, the elk, and the antelope. The vigor and patience both of the men and horses are continually exercised by the fatigues of the chase, and the plentiful supply of game contributes to the subsistence and even luxury of a Tartar camp. But the exploits of the hunters of Scythia are not confined to the destruction of timid or innoxious beasts. They boldly encounter the angry wild boar when he turns against his pursuers, excite the sluggish courage of the bear, and provoke the fury of the tiger as he slumbers in the thicket. Where there is danger, there may be glory, and the mode of hunting which opens the fairest field to the exertions of valor may justly be considered as the image and as the school of war. The general hunting matches, the pride and delight of the Tartar princes, compose an instructive exercise for their numerous cavalry. A circle is drawn of many miles in conference to encompass the game of an extensive district, and the troops that form the circle regularly advance towards a common center, where the captive animals, surrounded on every side, are abandoned to the darts of the hunters. In this march, which frequently continues many days, the cavalry are obliged to climb the hills, to swim the rivers, and to wind through the valleys, without interrupting the prescribed order of their gradual progress. They acquire the habit of directing their eye and their steps to a remote object, of preserving their intervals of suspending or accelerating their pace, according to the motions of the troops on their right and left, and of watching and repeating the signals of their leaders. Their leaders study in this practical school the most important lesson of the military art, the prompt and accurate judgment of ground, of distance, and of time. To employ against a human enemy the same patience and valor, the same skill and discipline, is the only alteration which is required in real war, and the amusements of the chase serve as a prelude to the conquest of an empire. The political society of the ancient Germans has the appearance of a voluntary alliance of independent warriors. The tribes of Scythia, distinguished by the modern appellation of hordes, assume the form of a numerous and increasing family, which in the course of successive generations has been propagated from the same original stock. The meanest and the most ignorant of the Tartars preserve, with conscious pride, the inestimable treasure of their genealogy, And whatever distinctions of rank may have been introduced by the unequal distribution of pastoral wealth, they mutually respect themselves and each other as the descendants of the first founder of the tribe. The custom, which still prevails, of adopting the bravest and most faithful of the captives, may countenance the very probable suspicion that this extensive consanguinity is, in a great measure, legal and fictitious. But the useful prejudice, which has obtained the sanction of time and opinion, produces the effects of truth. The haughty barbarians yield a cheerful and voluntary obedience to the head of their blood, and their chief, or Muasa, as the representative of their great father, exercises the authority of a judge in peace and of a leader in war. In the original state of the pastoral world, each of the Muasas, if we may continue to use a modern appellation, acted as the independent chief of a large and separate family, and the limits of their peculiar territories were gradually fixed by superior force or mutual consent. But the constant operation of various and permanent causes contributed to unite the vagrant hordes into national communities under the command of a supreme head. The weak were desirous of support, and the strong were ambitious of dominion. The power which is the result of union oppressed and collected the divided force of the adjacent tribes, and as the vanquished were freely admitted to share the advantages of victory, the most valiant chiefs hastened to range themselves and their followers under the formidable standard of a confederate nation. The most successful of the Tatar princes assumed the military command to which he was entitled by the superiority either of merit or of power. He was raised to the throne by the acclamations of his equals, and the title of Khan expresses, in the language of the north of Asia, the full extent of the regal dignity. The right of hereditary succession was long confined to the blood of the founder of the monarchy, and at this moment all the Khans who reign from Crimea to the wall of China are the lineal descendants of the renowned Genghis. But as it is the indispensable duty of a Tatar sovereign to lead his warlike subjects into the field, the claims of an infant are often disregarded, and some royal kinsman, distinguished by his age and valor, is entrusted with the sword and scepter of his predecessor. Two distinct and regular taxes are levied on the tribes to support the dignity of the national monarch and of their peculiar chief, and each of those contributions amounts to the tithe, both of their property and of their spoil. A Tatar sovereign enjoys the tenth part of the wealth of his people, and as his own domestic riches of flocks and herds increase in a much larger proportion, he is able plentifully to maintain the rustic splendor of his court, to reward the most deserving or the most favored of his followers, and to obtain from the gentle influence of corruption the obedience which might be sometimes refused to the stern mandates of authority. The manners of his subjects, accustomed, like himself, to blood and rapine, might excuse, in their eyes, such partial acts of tyranny as would excite the horror of a civilized people. But the power of a despot has never been acknowledged in the deserts of Scythia. The immediate jurisdiction of the Khan is confined within the limits of his own tribe, and the exercise of his royal prerogative has been moderated by the ancient institution of a national council. The Korulai, or Diet, of the Tatars was regularly held in the spring and autumn, in the midst of a plain, where the princes of the reigning family and the Muasas of the respective tribes may conveniently assemble on horseback with their martial and numerous trains, and the ambitious monarch who reviewed the strength must consult the inclination of an armed people. The rudiments of a feudal government may be discovered in the constitution of the Scythian or Tatar nations, but the perpetual conflict of those hostile nations has sometimes terminated in the establishment of a powerful and despotic empire. The victor, enriched by the tribute and fortified by the arms of the dependent kings, has spread his conquests over Europe or Asia. The successful shepherds of the north have submitted to the confinement of arts, of laws, and of cities. And the introduction of luxury, after destroying the freedom of the people, has undermined the foundations of the throne. The memory of past events cannot long be preserved in the frequent and remote emigrations of illiterate barbarians. The modern Tatars are ignorant of the conquests of their ancestors, and our knowledge of the history of the Scythians is derived from their intercourse with the learned and civilized nations of the south, the Greeks, the Persians, and the Chinese. The Greeks, who navigated the Black Sea and planted their colonies along the seacoast, made the gradual and imperfect discovery of Scythia. From the Danube and the confines of Thrace, as far as the frozen Maeotis, the seat of eternal winter, and Mount Caucasus, which in the language of poetry was described as the utmost boundary of the earth. They celebrated with simple credulity the virtues of the pastoral life. They entertained a more rational apprehension of the strength and numbers of the warlike barbarians, who contemptuously baffled the immense armament of Darius, the son of Hystaspes. The Persian monarchs had extended their western conquests to the banks of the Danube and the limits of European Scythia. The eastern provinces of their empire were exposed to the Scythians of Asia. The wild inhabitants of the plains beyond the Oxus and the Euxates, two mighty rivers which direct their course towards the Caspian Sea. The long and memorable quarrel of Iran and Turan is still the theme of history or romance. The famous, perhaps the fabulous, valor of the Persian heroes Rustan and Asfandia was signalized in the defense of their country against the Afrasiabs of the north, and the invincible spirit of the same barbarians resisted, on the same ground, the victorious arms of Cyrus and Alexander. In the eyes of the Greeks and Persians, the real geography of Scythia was bounded, on the east, by the mountains of Emmaus, or Kaf, and their distant prospect of the extreme and inaccessible parts of Asia was clouded by ignorance or perplexed by fiction. But those inaccessible regions are the ancient residence of a powerful and civilized nation, which ascends by probable tradition above 40 centuries, and which is able to verify a series of near 2,000 years by the perpetual testimony of accurate and contemporary historians. The annals of China illustrate the state and revolutions of the pastoral tribes, which may still be distinguished by the vague appellation of Scythians or Tatars. The vassals, the enemies, and sometimes the conquerors of a great empire, whose policy has uniformly opposed the blind and impetuous valor of the barbarians of the north. From the mouth of the Danube to the Sea of Japan, the whole longitude of Scythia is about 110 degrees, which, in that parallel, are equal to more than 5,000 miles. The latitude of these extensive deserts cannot be so easily or so accurately measured, but from the 40th degree, which touches the wall of China, we may securely advance above 1,000 miles to the northward, till our progress is stopped by the excessive cold of Siberia. In that dreary climate, instead of the animated picture of a Tatar camp, the smoke that issues from the earth, or rather from the snow, betrays the subterraneous dwellings of the Tungusis and the Samoyedes. The want of horses and oxen is imperfectly supplied by the use of reindeer and of large dogs. And the conquerors of the earth insensibly degenerate into a race of deformed and diminutive savages who tremble at the sound of arms. Part 2. The Huns, who under the reign of Valens threatened the Empire of Rome, had been formidable in a much earlier period to the Empire of China. Their ancient, perhaps their original seat, was an extensive, though dry and barren, tract of country immediately on the north side of the Great Wall. Their place is at present occupied by the 49 hordes, or banners, of the Mongoose, a pastoral nation which consists of about 200,000 families. But the valor of the Huns had extended the narrow limits of their dominions, and their rustic chiefs, who assumed the appellation of Tanju, gradually became the conquerors and the sovereigns of a formidable empire. Towards the east, their victorious arms were stopped only by the ocean, and the tribes, which are thinly scattered between the Amur and the extreme peninsula of Korea, adhered with reluctance to the standard of the Huns. On the west, near the head of the Irtysh, in the valley of Emmaus, they found a more ample space and more numerous enemies. One of the lieutenants of the Tanju subdued in a single expedition 26 nations. The Igors, distinguished above the Tatar race by the use of letters, were in the number of his vassals, and by the strange connection of human events, the flight of one of those vagrant tribes recalled the victorious Parthians from the invasion of Syria. On the side of the north, the ocean was assigned as the limit of the power of the Huns. Without enemies to resist their progress or witnesses to contradict their vanity, they might securely achieve a real or imaginary conquest of the frozen regions of Siberia. The northern sea was fixed as the remote boundary of their empire, but the name of that sea on whose shores the patriot Sovu embraced the life of a shepherd and an exile may be transferred with much more probability to the Baikal, a capacious basin above 300 miles in length, which disdains the modest appellation of a lake, and which actually communicates with the seas of the north by the long course of the Angara, the Tungusha, and the Genesia. The submission of so many distant nations might flatter the pride of the Tanju, but the valor of the Huns could be rewarded only by the enjoyment of the wealth and luxury of the empire of the south. In the 3rd century before the Christian era, a wall of 1,500 miles in length was constructed to defend the frontiers of China against the inroads of the Huns. But this stupendous work, which holds a conspicuous place in the map of the world, has never contributed to the safety of an unwarlike people. The cavalry of the Tanju frequently consisted of 200,000 or 300,000 men, formidable by the matchless dexterity with which they managed their bows and their horses, by their hardy patience in supporting the inclemency of the weather, and by the incredible speed of their march, which was seldom checked by torrents or precipices, by the deepest rivers, or by the most lofty mountains. They spread themselves at once over the face of the country, and their rapid impetuosity surprised, astonished, and disconcerted the grave and elaborate tactics of a Chinese army. The Emperor Keoti, a soldier of fortune whose personal merit had raised him to the throne, marched against the Huns with those veteran troops which had been trained in the civil wars of China. But he was soon surrounded by the barbarians, and after a siege of 7 days, the monarch, hopeless of relief, was reduced to purchase his deliverance by an ignominious capitulation. The successors of Keoti, whose lives were dedicated to the arts of peace or the luxury of the palace, submitted to a more permanent disgrace. They too hastily confessed the insufficiency of arms and fortifications. They were too easily convinced that while the blazing signals announced on every side the approach of the Huns, the Chinese troops, who slept with the helmet on their head and the cuirass on their back, were destroyed by the incessant labor of ineffectual marches. A regular payment of money and silk was stipulated as the condition of a temporary and precarious peace. Than the wretched expedient of disguising a real tribute under the names of a gift or subsidy was practiced by the emperors of China as well as by those of Rome. But there still remained a more disgraceful article of tribute which violated the sacred feelings of humanity and nature. The hardships of the savage life which destroy in their infancy the children who are born with a less healthy and robust constitution introduced a remarkable disproportion between the numbers of the two sexes. The Tartars are an ugly and even deformed race, and while they consider their own women as the instruments of domestic labor, their desires, or rather their appetites, are directed to the enjoyment of more elegant beauty. A select band of the fairest maidens of China was annually devoted to the rude embraces of the Huns, and the alliance of the haughty Tanjus was secured by their marriage with the genuine or adopted daughters of the imperial family, which vainly attempted to escape the sacrilegious pollution. The situation of these unhappy victims is described in the verses of a Chinese princess, who laments that she had been condemned by her parents to a distant exile under a barbarian husband, who complains that sour milk was her only drink, raw flesh her only food, a tent her only palace, and who expresses in a strain of pathetic simplicity the natural wish that she were transformed into a bird to fly back to her dear country, the object of her tender and perpetual regret. The conquest of China has been twice achieved by the pastoral tribes of the north. The forces of the Huns were not inferior to those of the Mughals or of the Manchu, and their ambition might entertain the most sanguine hopes of success. But their pride was humbled, and their progress was checked by the arms and policy of Wuti, the fifth emperor of the powerful dynasty of the Han. In his long reign of 54 years, the barbarians of the southern provinces submitted to the laws and manners of China, and the ancient limits of the monarchy were enlarged from the great river of Qiang to the port of Canton. Instead of confining himself to the timid operations of a defensive war, his lieutenants penetrated many hundred miles into the country of the Huns. In those boundless deserts where it is impossible to form magazines and difficult to transport a sufficient supply of provisions, the armies of Wuti were repeatedly exposed to intolerable hardships, and of 140,000 soldiers who marched against the barbarians, 30,000 only returned in safety to the feet of their master. These losses, however, were compensated by splendid and decisive success. The Chinese generals improved the superiority which they derived from the temper of their arms, their chariots of war, and the service of their Tartar auxiliaries. The camp of the Tanju was surprised in the midst of sleep and intemperance, and though the monarch of the Huns bravely cut his way through the ranks of the enemy, he left above 15,000 of his subjects on the field of battle. Yet this signal victory, which was preceded and followed by many bloody engagements, contributed much less to the destruction of the power of the Huns than the effectual policy which was employed to detach the tributary nations from their obedience. Intimidated by the arms or allured by the promises of Wuti and his successors, the most considerable tribes, both of the east and of the west, disclaimed the authority of the Tanju. While some acknowledged themselves the allies or vassals of the empire, they all became the implacable enemies of the Huns, and the numbers of that haughty people, as soon as they were reduced to their native strength, might perhaps have been contained within the walls of one of the great and populous cities of China. The desertion of his subjects and the perplexity of a civil war at length compelled the Tanju himself to renounce the dignity of an independent sovereign and the freedom of a warlike and high-spirited nation. He was received at Sigan, the capital of the monarchy, by the troops, the mandarins, and the emperor himself, with all the honors that could adorn and disguise the triumph of Chinese vanity. A magnificent palace was prepared for his reception. His place was assigned above all the princes of the royal family, and the patience of the barbarian king was exhausted by the ceremonies of a banquet which consisted of 8 courses of meat and of 9 solemn pieces of music. But he performed on his knees the duty of a respectful homage to the Emperor of China, pronounced in his own name and in the name of his successors a perpetual oath of fidelity, and gratefully accepted a seal which was bestowed as the emblem of his regal dependence. After this humiliating submission, the Tanjus sometimes departed from their allegiance and seized the favorable moments of war and rapine. But the monarchy of the Huns gradually declined, till it was broken, by civil dissension, into 2 hostile and separate kingdoms. One of the princes of the nation was urged by fear and ambition to retire towards the south with 8 hordes, which composed between 40,000 and 50,000 families. He obtained, with the title of Tanju, a convenient territory on the verge of the Chinese provinces, and his constant attachment to the service of the empire was secured by weakness and the desire of revenge. From the time of this fatal schism, the Huns of the north continued to languish about 50 years, till they were oppressed on every side by their foreign and domestic enemies. The proud inscription of a column erected on a lofty mountain announced to posterity that a Chinese army had marched 700 miles into the heart of their country. The Xianpi, a tribe of Oriental Tatars, retaliated the injuries which they had formerly sustained, and the power of the Tanjus, after a reign of 1,300 years, was utterly destroyed before the end of the 1st century of the Christian era. The fate of the vanquished Huns was diversified by the various influence of character and situation. Above 100,000 persons, the poorest indeed and the most pusillanimous of the people, were contented to remain in their native country, to renounce their peculiar name and origin, and to mingle with the victorious nation of the Xianpi. 58 hordes, about 200,000 men, ambitious of a more honorable servitude, retired towards the south, implored the protection of the emperors of China, and were permitted to inhabit and to guard the extreme frontiers of the province of Chansi and the territory of Ortus. But the most warlike and powerful tribes of the Huns maintained in their adverse fortune the undaunted spirit of their ancestors. The Western world was open to their valor, and they resolved, under the conduct of their hereditary chieftains, to conquer and subdue some remote country which was still inaccessible to the arms of the Xianpi and to the laws of China. The course of their emigration soon carried them beyond the mountains of Emmaus and the limits of the Chinese geography. But we are able to distinguish the 2 great divisions of these formidable exiles which directed their march towards the Oxus and towards the Volga. The first of these colonies established their dominion in the fruitful and extensive plains of Sogdiana, on the eastern side of the Caspian, where they preserved the name of Huns, with the epithet of Euthalites, or Nephthalites. Their manners were softened, and even their features were insensibly improved by the mildness of the climate and their long residence in a flourishing province, which might still retain a faint impression of the arts of Greece. The White Huns, a name which they derived from the change of their complexions, soon abandoned the pastoral life of Scythia. Gorgo, which under the appellation of Carizmi has since enjoyed a temporary splendor, was the residence of the king who exercised a legal authority over an obedient people. Their luxury was maintained by the labor of the Sogdians, and the only vestige of their ancient barbarism was the custom which obliged all the companions, perhaps to the number of 20, who had shared the liberality of a wealthy lord, to be buried alive in the same grave. The vicinity of the Huns to the provinces of Persia involved them in frequent and bloody contests with the power of that monarchy. But they respected in peace the faith of treaties, in war the dictates of humanity, and their memorable victory over Parisis, or Firuz, displayed the moderation as well as the valour of the barbarians. The second division of their countrymen, the Huns, who gradually advanced towards the northwest, were exercised by the hardships of a colder climate and a more laborious march. Necessity compelled them to exchange the silks of China for the furs of Siberia. The imperfect rudiments of civilized life were obliterated, and the native fierceness of the Huns was exasperated by their intercourse with the savage tribes, who were compared with some propriety to the wild beasts of the desert. Their independent spirit soon rejected the hereditary succession of the Tanjus, and while each horde was governed by its peculiar mursa, their tumultuary council directed the public measures of the whole nation. As late as the 13th century, their transient residence on the eastern banks of the Volga was attested by the name of Great Hungary. In the winter, they descended with their flocks and herds towards the mouth of that mighty river, and their summer excursions reached as high as the latitude of Saratov, or perhaps the conflux of the Kama. Such at least were the recent limits of the Black Kalmucks, who remained about a century under the protection of Russia, and who have since returned to their native seats on the frontiers of the Chinese Empire. The march and the return of those wandering Tartars, whose united camp consists of 50,000 tents or families, illustrate the distant immigrations of the ancient Huns. It is impossible to fill the dark interval of time which elapsed after the Huns of the Volga were lost in the eyes of the Chinese, and before they showed themselves to those of the Romans. There is some reason, however, to apprehend that the same force which had driven them from their native seats still continued to impel their march towards the frontiers of Europe. The power of the CNP, their implacable enemies, which extended above 3,000 miles from east to west, must have gradually oppressed them by the weight and terror of a formidable neighborhood, and the flight of the tribes of Scythia would inevitably tend to increase the strength or to contract the territories of the Huns. The harsh and obscure appellations of those tribes would offend the ear without informing the understanding of the reader. But I cannot suppress the very natural suspicion that the Huns of the North derived a considerable reinforcement from the ruin of the dynasty of the South, which in the course of the 3rd century submitted to the dominion of China, that the bravest warriors marched away in search of their free and adventurous countrymen, and that, as they had been divided by prosperity, they were easily reunited by the common hardships of their adverse fortune. The Huns, with their flocks and herds, their wives and children, their dependents and allies, were transported to the west of the Volga, and they boldly advanced to invade the country of the Alani, a pastoral people who occupied, or wasted, an extensive tract of the deserts of Scythia. The plains between the Volga and the Tanais were covered with the tents of the Alani, but their name and manners were diffused over the wide extent of their conquests, and the painted tribes of the Agathyrsi and the Galoni were confounded among their vassals. Towards the north, they penetrated into the frozen regions of Siberia, among the savages who were accustomed, in their rage or hunger, to the taste of human flesh. And their southern inroads were pushed as far as the confines of Persia and India. The mixture of Sarmatic and German blood had contributed to improve the features of the Alani, to whiten their swarthy complexions, and to tinge their hair with a yellowish cast, which is seldom found in the Tartar race. They were less deformed in their persons, less brutish in their manners than the Huns, but they did not yield to those formidable barbarians and their martial and independent spirit, in a love of freedom which rejected even the use of domestic slaves, and in the love of arms which considered war and rapine as the pleasure and the glory of mankind. A naked scimitar, fixed in the ground, was the only object of their religious worship. The scalps of their enemies formed the costly trappings of their horses, and they viewed with pity and contempt the pusillanimous warriors who patiently expected the infirmities of age and the tortures of lingering disease. On the banks of the Tanais, the military power of the Huns and the Alani encountered each other with equal valor, but with unequal success. The Huns prevailed in the bloody contest. The king of the Alani was slain, and the remains of the vanquished nation were dispersed by the ordinary alternative of flight or submission. A colony of exiles found a secure refuge in the mountains of Caucasus, between the Black Sea and the Caspian, where they still preserve their name and their independence. Another colony advanced, with more intrepid courage, towards the shores of the Baltic, associated themselves with the northern tribes of Germany, and shared the spoil of the Roman provinces of Gaul and Spain. But the greatest part of the nation of the Alani embraced the offers of an honorable and advantageous union. And the Huns, who esteemed the valor of their less fortunate enemies, proceeded with an increase of numbers and confidence to invade the limits of the Gothic Empire. The great Hermanric, whose dominions extended from the Baltic to the Black Sea, enjoyed in the full maturity of age and reputation the fruit of his victories when he was alarmed by the formidable approach of a host of unknown enemies on whom his barbarous subjects might, without injustice, bestow the epithet of barbarians. The numbers, the strength, the rapid motions, and the implacable cruelty of the Huns were felt and dreaded and magnified by the astonished Goths, who beheld their fields and villages consumed with flames and deluged with indiscriminate slaughter. To these real terrors they added these surprise and abhorrence, which were excited by the shrill voice, the uncouth gestures, and the strange deformity of the Huns. These savages of Scythia were compared, and the picture had some resemblance, to the animals who walk very awkwardly on two legs, and to the misshapen figures, the termini, which were often placed on the bridges of antiquity. They were distinguished from the rest of the human species by their broad shoulders, flat noses, and small black eyes deeply buried in the head, and as they were almost destitute of beards, they never enjoyed either the manly grace of youth or the venerable aspect of age. A fabulous origin was assigned, worthy of their form and manners, that the witches of Scythia, who for their foul and deadly practices had been driven from society, had copulated in the desert with infernal spirits, and that the Huns were the offspring of this execrable conjunction. The tale, so full of horror and absurdity, was greedily embraced by the credulous hatred of the Goths. But while it gratified their hatred, it increased their fear, since the posterity of demons and witches might be supposed to inherit some share of the preternatural powers, as well as of the malignant temper of their parents. Against these enemies, Hermanric prepared to exert the united forces of the Gothic state, but he soon discovered that his vassal tribes, provoked by oppression, were much more inclined to second than to repel the invasion of the Huns. One of the chiefs of the Roxolani had formerly deserted the standard of Hermanric, and the cruel tyrant had condemned the innocent wife of the traitor to be torn asunder by wild horses. The brothers of that unfortunate woman seized the favorable moment of revenge. The aged king of the Goths languished some time after the dangerous wound which he received from their daggers, but the conduct of the war was retarded by his infirmities, and the public councils of the nation were distracted by a spirit of jealousy and discord. His death, which has been imputed to his own despair, left the reins of government in the hands of Withymer, who, with the doubtful aid of some Scythian mercenaries, maintained the unequal contest against the arms of the Huns and the Alani till he was defeated and slain in a decisive battle. The Ostrogoths submitted to their fate, and the royal race of the Amale will hereafter be found among the subjects of the haughty Attila. But the person of Witheric, the infant king, was saved by the diligence of Alathius and Saphrax, two warriors of approved valor and fidelity, who, by cautious marches, conducted the independent remains of the nation of the Ostrogoths towards the Dynastus, or Dniester, a considerable river which now separates the Turkish dominions from the Empire of Russia. On the banks of the Dniester, the prudent Athanaric, more attentive to his own than to the general safety, had fixed the camp of the Visigoths, with the firm resolution of opposing the victorious barbarians whom he thought it less advisable to provoke. The ordinary speed of the Huns was checked by the weight of baggage and the encumbrance of captives, but their military skill deceived and almost destroyed the army of Athanaric. While the judge of the Visigoths defended the banks of the Dniester, he was encompassed and attacked by a numerous detachment of cavalry, who, by the light of the moon, had passed the river in a formidable place. And it was not without the utmost efforts of courage and conduct that he was able to effect his retreat towards the hilly country. The undaunted general had already formed a new and judicious plan of defensive war, and the strong lines which he was preparing to construct between the mountains, the Pruth, and the Danube would have secured the extensive and fertile territory that bears the modern name of Wallachia from the destructive inroads of the Huns. But the hopes and measures of the judge of the Visigoths were soon disappointed by the trembling impatience of his dismayed countrymen, who were persuaded by their fears that the interposition of the Danube was the only barrier that could save them from the rapid pursuit and invincible valor of the barbarians of Scythia. Under the command of Fritigern and Olavivus, the body of the nation hastily advanced to the banks of the great river and implored the protection of the Roman Emperor of the East. Athanaric himself, still anxious to avoid the guilt of perjury, retired with a band of faithful followers into the mountainous country of Caucaland, which appears to have been guarded and almost concealed by the impenetrable forests of Transylvania. After Valens had terminated the Gothic War with some appearance of glory and success, he made a progress through his dominions of Asia, and at length fixed his residence in the capital of Syria. The 5 years which he spent at Antioch was employed to watch from a secure distance the hostile designs of the Persian monarch, to check the depredations of the Saracens and Isaurians, to enforce, by arguments more prevalent than those of reason and eloquence, the belief of the Arian theology, and to satisfy his anxious suspicions by the promiscuous execution of the innocent and the guilty. But the attention of the emperor was most seriously engaged by the important intelligence which he received from the civil and military officers who were entrusted with the defense of the Danube. He was informed that the north was agitated by furious tempest, that the eruption of the Huns, an unknown and monstrous race of savages, had subverted the power of the Goths, and that the suppliant multitudes of that warlike nation, whose pride was now humbled in the dust, covered a space of many miles along the banks of the river. With outstretched arms and pathetic lamentations, they loudly deplored their past misfortunes and their present danger, acknowledged that their only hope of safety was in the clemency of the Roman government, and most solemnly protested that if the gracious liberality of the emperor would permit them to cultivate the wastelands of Thrace, they should ever hold themselves bound by the strongest obligations of duty and gratitude to obey the laws and to guard the limits of the republic. These assurances were confirmed by the ambassadors of the Goths, who impatiently expected from the mouth of Valens an answer that must finally determine the fate of their unhappy countrymen. The Emperor of the East was no longer guided by the wisdom and authority of his elder brother, whose death happened towards the end of the preceding year. And as the distressful situation of the Goths required an instant and peremptory decision, he was deprived of the favorite resources of feeble and timid minds, who consider the use of dilatory and ambiguous measures as the most admirable efforts of consummate prudence. As long as the same passions and interests subsist among mankind, the questions of war and peace, of justice and policy, which were debated in the councils of antiquity, will frequently present themselves as the subject of modern deliberation. But the most experienced statesman of Europe has never been summoned to consider the propriety or the danger of admitting or rejecting an innumerable multitude of barbarians who are driven by despair and hunger to solicit a settlement on the territories of a civilized nation. When that important proposition, so essentially connected with the public safety, was referred to the ministers of Valens, they were perplexed and divided. But they soon acquiesced in the flattering sentiment which seemed the most favorable to the pride, the indolence, and the avarice of their sovereign. The slaves, who were decorated with the titles of prefects and generals, dissembled or disregarded the terrors of this national emigration, so extremely different from the partial and accidental colonies which had been received on the extreme limits of the empire. But they applauded the liberality of fortune which had conducted, from the most distant countries of the globe, a numerous and invincible army of strangers to defend the throne of Valens, who might now add to the royal treasures the immense sums of gold supplied by the provincials to compensate their annual proportion of recruits. The prayers of the Goths were granted, and their service was accepted by the imperial court, and orders were immediately dispatched to the civil and military governors of the Thracian diocese to make the necessary preparations for the passage and subsistence of a great people, till a proper and sufficient territory could be allotted for their future residence. The liberality of the emperor was accompanied, however, with two harsh and rigorous conditions, which prudence might justify on the side of the Romans, but which distress alone could extort from the indignant Goths. Before they passed the Danube, they were required to deliver their arms, and it was insisted that their children should be taken from them, and dispersed through the provinces of Asia, where they might be civilized by the arts of education, and serve as hostages to secure the fidelity of their parents. Part 3. During the suspense of a doubtful and distant negotiation, the impatient Goths made some rash attempts to pass the Danube without the permission of the government, whose protection they had implored. Their motions were strictly observed by the vigilance of the troops which were stationed along the river, and their foremost detachments were defeated with considerable slaughter. Yet such were the timid counsels of the reign of Valens that the brave officers who had served their country in the execution of their duty were punished by the loss of their employments and narrowly escaped the loss of their heads. The imperial mandate was at length received for transporting over the Danube the whole body of the Gothic nation. But the execution of this order was a task of labor and difficulty. The stream of the Danube, which in those parts is above a mile broad, had been swelled by incessant rains, and in this tumultuous passage many were swept away and drowned by the rapid violence of the current. A large fleet of vessels, of boats, and of canoes was provided. Many days and nights they passed and repassed with indefatigable toil. And the most strenuous diligence was exerted by the officers of Valens that not a single barbarian of those who were reserved to subvert the foundations of Rome should be left on the opposite shore. It was thought expedient that an accurate account should be taken of their numbers, but the persons who were employed soon desisted with amazement and dismay from the prosecution of the endless and impracticable task, and the principal historian of the age most seriously affirms that the prodigious armies of Darius and Xerxes, which had so long been considered as the fables of vain and credulous antiquity, were now justified in the eyes of mankind by the evidence of fact and experience. A probable testimony has fixed the number of the Gothic warriors at 200,000 men. And if we can venture to add the just proportion of women, of children, and of slaves, the whole mass of people which composed this formidable emigration must have amounted to near a million of persons, of both sexes and of all ages. The children of the Goths, those at least of a distinguished rank, were separated from the multitude. They were conducted, without delay, to the distant seats assigned for their residence and education. And as the numerous train of hostages or captives passed through the cities, their gay and splendid apparel, their robust and martial figure, excited the surprise and envy of the provincials. But the stipulation, the most offensive to the Goths, and the most important to the Romans, was shamefully eluded. The barbarians, who considered their arms as the ensigns of honor and the pledges of safety, were disposed to offer a price which the lust or avarice of the imperial officers was easily tempted to accept. To preserve their arms, the haughty warriors consented, with some reluctance, to prostitute their wives or their daughters. The charms of a beautiful maid or a comely boy secured the connivance of the inspectors, who sometimes cast an eye of covetousness on the fringed carpets and linen garments of the new allies, or who sacrificed their duty to the mean consideration of filling their farms with cattle and their houses with slaves. The Goths, with arms in their hands, were permitted to enter the boats, and when their strength was collected on the other side of the river, the immense camp, which was spread over the plains and the hills of the lower Mysia, assumed a threatening and even hostile aspect. The leaders of the Ostrogoths, Alathius and Saphrax, the guardians of their infant king, appeared soon afterwards on the northern banks of the Danube, and immediately dispatched their ambassadors to the court of Antioch to solicit, with the same professions of allegiance and gratitude, the same favor which had been granted to the suppliant Visigoths. The absolute refusal of Valens suspended their progress, and discovered the repentance, the suspicions, and the fears of the imperial council. An undisciplined and unsettled nation of barbarians required the firmest temper and the most dexterous management. The daily subsistence of near a million of extraordinary subjects could be supplied only by constant and skillful diligence, and might continually be interrupted by mistake or accident. The insolence or the indignation of the Goths, if they conceived themselves to be the objects either of fear or of contempt, might urge them to the most desperate extremities, and the fortune of the state seemed to depend on the prudence as well as the integrity of the generals of Valens. At this important crisis, the military government of Thrace was exercised by Lupicinus and Maximus, in whose venal minds the slightest hope of private emolument outweighed every consideration of public advantage, and whose guilt was only alleviated by their incapacity of discerning the pernicious effects of their rash and criminal administration. Instead of obeying the orders of their sovereign, and satisfying with decent liberality the demands of the Goths, they levied an ungenerous and oppressive tax on the wants of the hungry barbarians. The vilest food was sold at an extravagant price, and in the room of wholesome and substantial provisions, the markets were filled with the flesh of dogs and of unclean animals who had died of disease. To obtain the valuable acquisition of a pound of bread, the Goths resigned the possession of an expensive, though serviceable, slave, and a small quantity of meat was greedily purchased with 10 pounds of a precious but useless metal. When their property was exhausted, they continued this necessary traffic by the sale of their sons and daughters, and notwithstanding the love of freedom which animated every Gothic breast, they submitted to the humiliating maxim that it was better for their children to be maintained in a servile condition than to perish in a state of wretched and helpless independence. The most lively resentment is excited by the tyranny of pretended benefactors who sternly exact the debt of gratitude which they have cancelled by subsequent injuries. A spirit of discontent insensibly arose in the camp of the barbarians who pleaded, without success, the merit of their patient and dutiful behavior, and loudly complained of the inhospitable treatment which they had received from their new allies. They beheld around them the wealth and plenty of a fertile province, in the midst of which they suffered the intolerable hardships of artificial famine. But the means of relief and even of revenge were in their hands, since the rapaciousness of their tyrants had left to an injured people the possession and the use of arms. The clamors of a multitude, untaught to disguise their sentiments, announced the first symptoms of resistance, and alarmed the timid and guilty minds of Lupicinus and Maximus. Those crafty ministers who substituted the cunning of temporary expedients to the wise and salutary counsels of general policy attempted to remove the Goths from their dangerous station on the frontiers of the empire, and to disperse them in separate quarters of cantonment through the interior provinces. As they were conscious how ill they had deserved the respect or confidence of the barbarians, they diligently collected from every side a military force that might urge the tardy and reluctant march of a people who had not yet renounced the title or the duties of Roman subjects. But the generals of Valens, while their attention was solely directed to the discontented Visigoths, imprudently disarmed the ships and the fortifications which constituted the defense of the Danube. The fatal oversight was observed and improved by Alathius and Saphrax, who anxiously watched the favorable moment of escaping from the pursuit of the Huns. By the help of such rafts and vessels as could be hastily procured, the leaders of the Ostrogoths transported, without opposition, their king and their army, and boldly fixed a hostile and independent camp on the territories of the empire. Under the name of judges, Alavivus and Fritigern were the leaders of the Visigoths in peace and war, and the authority which they derived from their birth was ratified by the free consent of the nation. In a season of tranquility, their power might have been equal, as well as their rank. But as soon as their countrymen were exasperated by hunger and oppression, the superior abilities of Fritigern assumed the military command, which he was qualified to exercise for the public welfare. He restrained the impatient spirit of the Visigoths till the injuries and the insults of their tyrants should justify their resistance in the opinion of mankind. But he was not disposed to sacrifice any solid advantages for the empty praise of justice and moderation. Sensible of the benefits which would result from the union of the Gothic powers under the same standard, he secretly cultivated the friendship of the Ostrogoths, and while he professed an implicit obedience to the orders of the Roman generals, he proceeded by slow marches towards Marcianopolis, the capital of the Lower Mysia, about 70 miles from the banks of the Danube. On that fatal spot, the flames of discord and mutual hatred burst forth into a dreadful conflagration. Lupicinus had invited the Gothic chiefs to a splendid entertainment, and their martial train remained under arms at the entrance of the palace. But the gates of the city were strictly guarded, and the barbarians were sternly excluded from the use of a plentiful market, to which they asserted their equal claim of subjects and allies. Their humble prayers were rejected with insolence and derision, and as their patience was now exhausted, the townsmen, the soldiers, and the Goths were soon involved in a